Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is the human microbiome. According to researchers, there are 100 trillion microorganisms living in each human body. If that is startling, consider that the gastrointestinal tract alone has between 500 and 1,000 different species of bacteria that perform essential digestive functions. In fact, these tiny creatures are considered so crucial in the gut that some have dubbed their collective presence a forgotten organ. But despite their massive numbers, not much was known about the trillions of organisms that live in our bodies. Until recently. Now, DNA mapping technology is allowing researchers to create a detailed picture of how these organisms work together with our cells to keep humans healthy. This information about what is called the human microbiome is providing new insights that may change how we prevent and treat many chronic diseases, such as colitis, asthma, obesity, and more. Tonight, we are talking about the human microbiome with some of the nation's leading researchers and experts, who are conveniently located right here in the Bay Area. Here in the KLW studio, we have three guests. Dr. Katie Pollard is a senior investigator and the founder of the Bioinformatics Corps at Gladstone Institutes, an independent medical research organization based in San Francisco. Dr. Pollard's lab develops statistical and computational methods for analyzing the massive data sets that emerge from genomic research. She is also a professor in the UCSF Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics and Institute for Human Genetics. Welcome, Katie.
Welcome. Thanks.
Dr. Susan Lynch is Associate Professor in the Division of Gastroenterology and the Department of Medicine at UCSF, where she also directs the Colitis and Crohn's Disease Microbiome Research Corps. Her research examines microbial community composition and function in an effort to better understand how these communities interact with the human host and impact chronic inflammatory disease. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you.
And Peter DeLora is the president and CEO of Second Genome, a biotech company based in South San Francisco that brings microbiome science to the discovery and development of therapeutic products for addressing inflammation and metabolic diseases. Prior to coming to Second Genome, Peter was an executive at Ingenuity Systems, where he was responsible for business development, global sales and marketing, and corporate strategy. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, David.
Later in the show, we will invite you, our listeners, to call in and join our conversation. If you have a question, you can also email us right now at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Katie, let's start with you. Can you explain to our listeners what is the human microbiome exactly?
Great question, David. So the human microbiome is a collection of microorganisms, mostly bacteria, but also other types of microorganisms that live in and on the human body. And what people may not be aware of is that one in 10 cells in our body is human, and the other nine are actually part of the microbiome. They're bacteria and other organisms that aren't human. These are of thousands of different types, as you mentioned in the introduction. And so each one of those organisms has its own DNA and its own collection of genes. And if you do a little back-of-the-envelope calculation, that means that only out of 100 genes in our body, only one is human, and the other 99 are coming from the genomes of these other organisms.
That is amazing to know there are that many living things that are part of our body, not of our body, but part of it. Why is this so important, Susan?
I think it's really key because one of the things that we've considered before this was that there were privileged sites in the human body. And what we're starting to uncover is that every site that we have examined to date is colonized by microbes. The sinuses, for example, are overtly colonized by microbial colonists at that site. And these organisms, as we know they do in the gut, they perform functions and interact with both each other and the host. And those interactions define the host response, the immune response, and the overall health of the individual. So much of our function, as Katie alluded to, is derived from the microbial colonizers in and on the human body.
And Peter, let me turn to you. Why suddenly is there this wealth of research that is coming out in recent years on this after really, despite its importance, we really didn't know very much about it until very recently?
Yeah, I think there are really a couple drivers for that, David. I think in part the technologies that allow us to look at these bacterial communities have improved. So things like next-generation sequencing technologies now allow us to look at this full community. And then the other really critical thing is the computational power required to make sense of these massive data sets that are being created by sequencing is really required for the interpretation. So we've got this really transformational notion that our bodies are not entirely human. As Katie pointed out, we're only 1 in 100 human in the biology that we're carrying around, and so we have to change this almost narcissistic perspective with which we've been looking
it
at.
It is human humbling,
biology.
Isn't it?
Yeah, right. That's right.
Just building on the idea of the computation being important, that's the emphasis in my lab at the Gladstone Institutes, and. It's having computers, so supercomputing, high-performance computing is really key. That's a technology, but it's also the information technology that goes with that, the people who are able to sort through this data. By way of an analogy, you can think of the human microbiome as made up of books, where each book is an organism, and there's information in the book. The experiment, the sequencing experiment that we were just talking about, is analogous to taking the pages out of the book and tearing them up, putting them all in a big pile so you don't know which page came from which book, and you just have a few words from each page that you sample, and then you're trying to reconstruct all the information in that library. So the sequencing technology allows you to acquire this data, but making sense of it is a huge problem and continues to be going forward.
And that is work that you're doing at the Gladstone Institute. Can you tell us a little bit about the Institute and the type of work that it does?
So Gladstone has three main disease focuses. We look at cardiovascular disease, neurodegenerative disease, and virology and immunology. And you might think the immunology, the immune system, would be where the microbiome is most relevant. Indeed, it is. But we're seeing that the microbiome really plays a role in many aspects of both human health and also many different diseases where you would never expect it to play a role. For example, there have been some studies coming out that have shown that what's going on in your gut with the microbes in your gut can actually affect what's going on in your brain.
So I want to really delve into that as we move on about just how many different areas this may eventually we may learn that this is affecting. But let me start by, Susan, you had talked about the various places in the body. Can you explain the various parts of the body where we find the most, where most microbiome is?
That would be the gastrointestinal tract, and that's been pretty well established. The burden of organisms in the lower GI tract is immense, and that's where much of our metabolism occurs as well. And thinking in terms to hurl back to that idea of a gut-brain axis, or for example, in our group, we've been examining a gut airway axis. We see that if we manipulate the gut microbiome in animals or actually in humans, that we can change airway responses to allergen challenge and viral infection. And we've been thinking about how this might actually work. And the way we're viewing it is that the gut represents a major microbial bioreactor that pumps out a slew of distinct metabolites. And there's emerging evidence as well as established evidence that several of these metabolic products actually modulate various aspects of physiology, everything from epithelial barrier function in the gut to immune activation status. And so when we think about this, we have to stop thinking in both linear terms and thinking that there's only one pathway to develop disease. It is a very complex and multifaceted problem that we're facing, but with these next-gen technologies, we're starting to go beyond a single species that we believed were the only drivers of disease for a handful of diseases and start to understand, as Katie mentioned, that pretty much every disease that we're looking at now has a microbiome component. One of the issues comes with that, and one of the questions that's there is the chicken and egg question, is the perturbations to these communities of microbes, for example, in the gut, a result of the disease processes, or is there a perturbation initially that drives the disease event in the first place?
Right, so cause and effect is hard to figure out here.
It's hard to figure out there.
But can you give for our listeners just a basic example of some research you're doing on a specific disease that and kind of what that research showed specifically?
Sure. Well, we're really interested in the causal pathway to disease development. And we know, for example, for asthma, which is one of the diseases we study in our group, that there is an environmental component as well as a microbial component. And so what we have shown in a number of studies recently is that environmental microbial exposures for infants in their household households in the first year of life are related to disease outcomes. Children in the inner city who are exposed to a slew of 82 distinct bacteria do not go on to develop allergy and asthma at age 3. On the contrary, those children in households that are not exposed to those microbial components in their household environment go on with very high rates to develop disease. And what we've been considering is that this environmental exposure in the households of these children serves to inoculate the gut microbiome and change the immune response to allergen challenge. And we've delved a little into this with animal models, where we've taken animals and we've fed them house dust from very distinct microbial environments, one that is considered protective against allergy development and one that's considered perhaps contributory to development of the disease. And what we show is that if you feed the animals with these distinct dust microbes, that you can then challenge the animals with allergen into the airways, and actually the animals that have been fed the dust from the protective environment, their airways are protected against allergen challenge. We've moreover shown that this is mediated by a change in the gut microbiome, and we've identified specific organisms in the gut that afford that protective effect in the airways. So again, getting back to the idea that the species and their products in the gut microbiome have far-reaching effects at other mucosal surfaces in the body.
So, Peter, when you see a study like that, how far are we from actually being able to inoculate people with the right kind of microbiome into their system?
Well, I think it's really dependent on the type of indication or disease that you're trying to address. I think there are some areas where this causal link between the microbiome and host biology has been more established. Indications like the inflammatory bowel diseases and Crohn's and colitis, where you've got the bacterial community in the gut that's driving inflammation and impacting the barrier on the human biology side, is one area where some of that work has been done. Metabolic disease, looking at obesity and type 2 diabetes, is another area where it's still quite early, but we're starting to see some of these causal connections. So I think while we know that the microbiome has implications in a really wide range of potential areas, we have to be pretty selective about the specific areas that we can pursue for therapeutic development.
Just to build on that, Peter, I think one of the challenges is that it's relatively easy now to describe what types of microbes are present and to associate those with diseases. But what probably matters the most for developing a therapeutic, which is what we were talking about, is to know what the functions those microbes are performing are in the body. And the challenge is that microbes are really wily. So they evolve fast, and organisms that we might call the same species, they're really closely related, can have a large number of their genes totally different. And work that my lab's been doing looking at strain level variation, so within a particular type of microbe that everyone would say was the same kind of microbe, we're seeing a third or half of the genes deleted or added in within one person's body from one cell to another cell. So it gets very complicated when you start talking about the actual genes and the functions that those organisms are performing. And yet that's kind of what we need to understand if we want to move forward and develop a drug or understand why an inoculation might work or something like that.
I agree. And the other thing we tend to do is to lump everything together. For example, ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, that's a very umbrella term for a broad spectrum of disease severities and disease manifestations. And what we need to do is be far more refined with respect to which kinds of microbiota drive which kinds of manifestations in a specific disease, to understand whether we can rehabilitate specific kinds of microbiota more readily than others, and who are the best potential recipients for example, a microbiome manipulation. It may work in one group of patients over another more readily by virtue of the fact that they have a specific type of microbiome that's driving their disease.
And in fact, don't we all have our own unique set of mm-hmm. microbiome? And so if that's the case, then it is very hard to figure out how to tailor something to an individual.
Yeah, I agree. We do, as healthy individuals, we have this great variety of microbial species present. But what's really consistent consistent is the function across a variety of healthy individuals. The other thing we're starting to see is across chronic inflammatory diseases that there are subsets of microbiotypes in those umbrella diseases. And I think pursuing the composition and the function of those specific types of microbiomes and how they interact with human hosts is what's really critical to understanding who's the potentially the best recipient for a specific therapy or combination of therapies.
Yeah, I would agree in general that the functional profile is pretty constant, that there's a lot of things that all microbes do. But we're actually seeing that there's, you know, here and there a needle in the haystack that isn't stable. Mm-hmm. It's a gene family or a protein that varies a lot across even healthy people. And maybe that's where we should be looking as well, even, you know, instead of at the constant part of the pattern.
I completely agree. That's something that we've been doing with our group as well, is looking for moving beyond what is consistent and what we consider core functions of disease towards what is unique to specific subsets of patients with their own particular microbiota.
And in layman's terms, can you explain to our listeners why that would be so important in trying to get to the heart of what's causing these diseases?
Yeah, so it kind of goes back to what I mentioned earlier about how many microbial genes are floating around in our bodies. So we've got lots and lots of different genes in lots of different cells. And the microbes, in addition to being sort of fast evolving and changing all the time, as I mentioned, they're also very interdependent with one another. And so their effect on our body, either positive or negative, is going to be a very complicated thing. It's not going to be as simple as you have a cold because you have flu in most cases, right? So pathogens are what we're more familiar with. And we know a lot of the major human pathogens. We know how to detect them. We know what diseases they cause. But some of these more complex diseases like metabolic syndromes and the different inflammatory bowel diseases are probably not the result of a single microbe and are more about these complex interactions. And to be able to tease out those associations, we got to dig a little bit deeper into the data.
And in terms of digging into the data, let me just get to that, because the DNA work that you do, it's a massive amount of data, right, to be able to try to pour through and see this. Can you talk about how that works and what DNA technology is allowing us to do that we weren't previously able to do?
Yeah, it's pretty ridiculous, David. I'm constantly buying new computers for my lab and hard drives and trying to make the network go faster. I've been working in human genetics my entire career, and it was always a challenge, but never a huge challenge to have the computers keep up with the data. And in the last few years, it's just been this incredible race for us to stay ahead of the data, to be able to even move the files around or open them on the computer. So to put it in perspective, one of these sequencing experiments, so Susan and spits in a test tube, and I sequence the DNA of all the microbes in her saliva, that experiment would make enough data, for example, to fill up, I don't know, 30 or 40 laptop hard drives.
And so what are the challenges and opportunities for you, given that massive amount of data and your current computational power?
It's pretty sad, actually. It's kind of a plumbing problem. So we are getting better and better at milking the information out of the data, but what we struggle with is moving the data around, getting it off of the machine that generated it and into the computer that can analyze it, and then getting the numbers that tell us what we found there out, and then kind of putting those in a format so that other people can understand them. So these sort of movements of data are amazingly actually the challenge right now, more than the how to calculate, do the calculations.
I think we're in a situation where the data generation has gotten really inexpensive, but the data interpretation and being able to actually get actionable knowledge out of these huge data sets is really a significant challenge. And so a lot of that comes down to experimental design. How do you structure the right experiment where you're looking at not only the bacterial community, but also looking at the host biology, and doing so in a way where you can start to understand these connections? I think as both Katie and Susan pointed out, it's not we're dealing with very complex ecologies here. We're dealing with interactions between bacteria, and we're dealing with interactions from bacteria to host. And we're dealing with really a connective tissue that connects our microbial community, connects us to an entire outside world. The air we breathe, the food we eat, the water we drink, the bacteria we pick up when we push our cell phone against our ear. And so all these things are really impacting the microbiome that we're carrying around in our bodies. And we have to be able to understand and interpret how that connects to both wellness and disease.
It's a tall order. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue our conversation. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the human microbiome with three Bay Area experts, Dr. Katie Pollard, a senior investigator at the Gladstone Institute and professor at UCSF, Dr. Susan Lynch, an associate professor in the Division of Gastroenterology in the Department of Medicine at UCSF, and Peter DeLora, president and CEO of Second Genome, a biotech company based in South San Francisco. Shortly, we will open our phones to have you join our conversation. You can also email us now at cityvisions@klw.org or post a comment on our website at klw.org. Now, there's been a fair amount of press recently about mothers and babies and the human biome around mothers and babies and the type of birth and how that might affect in the baby's first hours what type what its bacterial structure is and what its future health is. I'd love to get insights into that. Let's start with you, Susan.
Sure. This is a really fascinating area of research. And there's been some wonderful studies by Maria Gloria Bella Dominguez that have shown that, as you alluded to, C-section babies, for example, start life with a very distinct microbial inoculum compared to babies who are born vaginally. The microbiome on those babies reflects the mother's microbiome. But C-section babies tend to have microbes that are associated with skin, Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, whereas vaginally born infants tend to have organisms like Sneethia and Lactobacillus, which are found in abundance in the mother's vaginal tract.
So what does that mean for the newborn baby?
Well, you know, one of the things that we were talking about earlier is interpretation of the data. And the nice thing is that we already have the shoulders of giants to stand on in microbial ecology of environmental environments, for example. And so the central tenets of microbial ecology still stand here. And what we know is that the pioneering organisms, and this goes for macroecology as well as microecology, the pioneering organisms in any given ecosystem strongly define the other kinds of species that get to colonize that site or that ecosystem. And over the first year of life, the gut microbiome, and we suspect the microbiome at all other sites on the infant's body, rapidly diversifies until it reaches somewhat of a steady state at somewhere around the age of 3, where the microbiome resembles that of the mother, the father, the adults in the family. And so we think that this is a particularly critical period because, by no small coincidence, it's the period in which the immune response develops. And that, we think, is the critical period in which microbial colonization may actually set up the system for its response to subsequent challenges or allergens or viral infections that the human may encounter. So this is a really critical period in human development, both from a microbiological as well as an immunological standpoint.
Yes, Katie.
Yeah, Susan, that sort of ties into what you were talking to earlier about asthma makes me think of sort of a more general hypothesis that I think your lab is probably pursuing and others, including my group, which is this cleanliness hypothesis. Mm-hmm. So we're all taking care of our infants and using different products and thinking about trying to keep them clean and healthy and not getting exposed to microbes too much. But actually, there's a pretty good argument that the rise of asthma and autoimmune diseases, allergies, all of these things may result from actually eliminating microbes that are healthy and good for us. So I think absolutely these first few years are critical, and maybe some of the things we're doing are actually harmful for our kids.
And if we take a step back, aren't there a number of diseases that have just grown exponentially in the past few decades as parents have started using the techniques that you're talking about?
Yeah. In Western nations, particularly for a Western lifestyle, a Western diet, antimicrobial use, for example, C-section delivery, there's a large number of factors here that have been associated with development of chronic inflammatory diseases in childhood. And the prevalence of those diseases is rapidly climbing.
Yeah. Let's go to Peter and then Katie.
Yeah, and if we're thinking about our microbiome like an organ that plays a critical part in human biology, over the last 70 years, particularly in Westernized nations, we've really waged an accidental war against this microbial community. We've changed the way infants are colonized as they come into the world. We've changed the diets that feed this microbial community in many ways. And then our use of antibiotics has really risen as well, which is which has a very profound effect on the shape and composition of a microbiome. So I think while we've been addressing many other health concerns with those approaches, we haven't been fully conscious of the impact that this plays on the microbial community. And so while it's correlative, the increases in some of the chronic epidemics of our time, like inflammatory diseases, autoimmune diseases, metabolic diseases, really are at least coincident with these changes that we've made to our microbiome.
Yeah, we don't normally think about conserving or conservation as relating to microorganisms. We think of things like bald eagles, but there is actually potentially a risk that organisms that have co-evolved with us for millions of years as the human species evolved and turned into its modern form may at some point not even be present in anybody's microbiome anymore. And my lab had a kind of neat project recently in collaboration with Carlos Bustamante at Stanford, where we looked at microbiome of Khoisan hunter-gatherers. People that live in South Africa don't have routine access to antibiotics or dental care, and certainly have a less cleanly lifestyle than probably the three of us do. And at least on Monday through Friday, maybe our weekends are dirtier. But I think what was really interesting there is we found that the couple of the most prevalent, the third, fourth, and I think sixth most prevalent microorganisms in these Khoisan people are essentially absent when you look in people in North America.
Very interesting. And what is the health of that group of people compared to the diseases we get here?
Well, they certainly have health problems, right? We were looking in the oral side, and most of these folks are missing teeth and have really what we would consider poor oral hygiene. And, you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. But if it also means they have no autoimmune disease, mm-hmm. you kind of have to make a choice about what you want to suffer with and not suffer with.
On the point of antibiotics, I want to probe that a little bit because there has been a lot of press about antibiotics generally and antibiotics particularly and the microbiome, and then get into probiotics and whether there's a way to restore some of this by diet or medicine. But, you know, with antibiotics, of course, there's been general concern about overuse of antibiotics. But when you read those general articles, they don't really talk about the microbiome in the same way. And this seems more focused and more dangerous in a way than what the mainstream media has generally been following.
Yeah, I think we have to, you know, for one, we have to be careful about how we talk about antibiotics because they've done wonderful things around extending life expectancy and really address many very significant health concerns. But I think we do have to realize that there is both the antibiotics that we consume as medicine for a specific disease, but also the antibiotics that we get through our food supply and other places that are really having what some consider to be a subtherapeutic effect on our microbiome. So the chicken we eat, the beef we eat, could be driving shifts in our microbial population as well.
And I think beyond just the fact that we may be consuming subclinical levels of those antimicrobials, we have to remember that those antimicrobials administered to those animals have effects on their microbiome and their metabolic processes. And indeed, probably the content of what we're eating has been altered quite dramatically through antibiotic use. So it's not just simply consuming subclinical levels of antimicrobials, it's consuming meats and pesticide-treated plants even that are fundamentally altered from that which we would have consumed 100 years ago.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing the human microbiome with three Bay Area experts, Dr. Katie Pollard, a senior investigator at Gladstone Institute and a professor at UCSF, Dr. Susan Lynch from UCSF, and Peter DeLora from Second Genome. We'd like to invite you to call in with your questions or comments. What do you want to know about the human microbiome? Do you or a loved one suffer from a chronic disease that is related to the health of the microbiome? Are you curious about how to keep your trillions of microorganisms happy? The number to call in to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or post a comment on our website at kalw.org. Let me flip it over to probiotics. Is there any evidence yet that you can actually consume things that would help build up the microbiome in a healthy way?
So this is a pretty fascinating field, and we talk about it like it's just, you know, developed over the last decade or two. And in truth, in the late 1800s, Eli Metchkinoff was supplementing rats and people with lactobacillus species to manipulate the, what he didn't know was the microbiome, the fecal flora, as it was called then, to elicit health effects. I think some of the issues that we have are the species that we use as probiotics are phylogenetically very restricted. There's very few types that we use, which means they're functionally quite restricted. And several of them lack certain functions. They require functions from their surrounding microbial co-colonizers to be truly functional and effective in the context of promoting health. So, for example, a lactobacillus species that I would consume may behave and have different functions in the context of my gut microbiome compared to you consuming the very same species. And so I think what's really necessary is to understand who are the necessary partners with those beneficial species that will consistently confer beneficial effects and specific functions necessary, for example, to modulate immune responses in specific diseases like ulcerative colitis or asthma, or the variety of diseases that we're considering them as treatment modalities.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. We have a call from Chris in Alameda. Chris, welcome to City Visions.
It's Karen.
Oh, okay, yes. Karen, welcome to City Visions. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much, yes. So the over-obsessiveness with everybody being sterile, you have to wipe your hands with chemical wipes before you go to the supermarket and touch a shopping cart, and people don't want their children to ever touch the ground or get dirty, and no one's getting any, you know, all the cesareans that are going on, which is ever-increasing, like you're talking about, and kids not getting all kinds of immunities from their mother because of the obsessive-compulsive sterile obsession in hospitals and birthing centers and everywhere. And, you know, for millions of years, women just had babies not in hospitals. I mean, some survived and some didn't. But nonetheless, we did get our immunities from our mothers during birth. And I think this is a very, very important issue. And I wonder if the tech industry and the genome and the binome, all you specialists out there, are talking to the doctors about the contamination of our food source with antibiotics. I know you brought that up. That is really insidious and really bad, and that's affecting everybody's biodynamic aspect of their body, because the animals are infused with it, their meat and their flesh and everything like that. So, this is a really, really important discussion. I hope you can deal with these things.
Thank you, Karen, for calling in. Who'd like to respond to Karen's comments?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think Karen brings up several great points. The thing is, I think it's really only very recently that we're starting to understand the implications of these kinds of practices on the microbiome and the magnitude of what those impacts can actually do to human physiology and human health. The technologies have only developed over the last 5 to 7 years. And I do think the physicians, at least my physician colleagues, are very well aware of this and want to study this and want to understand what are the implications of their current practices. So I do believe that there are physicians who are very much aware and very much considering the implications of what they do on the microbiome.
Yeah, I want to add that, Karen, we appreciate the sense of urgency that you were speaking with. The challenge is that to find real actionable items that a doctor could advise a patient about really requires a fair amount of basic science or research to establish those fundamental links. And that's exactly what the three of us are trying to do. I agree with you that this can't happen fast enough.
Let's go now to Mark calling in from El Cerrito. Mark, welcome to City Visions.
Hello, can you hear me?
We can, Mark. Welcome to City Visions.
Thank you. I'm a researcher in the area of indoor dampness and mold and health. We know that dampness and mold in buildings is related to increased risk of new asthma or asthma exacerbation. But the organisms involved are completely mysterious still. So, Dr. Lynch, do you have any notions about the relationships between the indoor microbiome as it might be related to dampness and mold, and what's going on in the human microbiome?
Absolutely. That is something that's ongoing in the group at the moment. We have a Sloan-funded study as well as an NIH-funded study to examine exactly that. We're looking at house dust microbiome. Beyond bacteria, we're also looking at fungi, and we're using these new technologies to profile the types of fungi that are present, and then to relate the overall microbial composition of the house to household features, ventilation, number of residents in the home, pet presence, and beyond that, also asking the question whether the house dust microbiome that's present in that home is related to the gut microbiome of infants who are raised in those homes, and whether those infants go on, depending on the type of home they've been raised in, to develop disease, allergic disease, and asthma or not. So again, looking at the whole causal pathway, looking at the microbial content in the environment of these infants, the infants themselves and their gut microbiome and their propensity to develop disease. So this is all ongoing work in our group at the moment.
That's excellent. Do you have any notion of the links yet?
Not quite yet. We are still at the data development stage, and we're about ready to start crunching all those millions of numbers that we have, and we'll be probably talking to Katie about it moving forward.
Katie.
Great.
Yeah, there's also an interesting study called the 1,000 Home Study, where people have sampled their own homes and sent in their data to a project where my lab has access to the data. In fact, anybody does. It's publicly available. It's not as rigorous or deep as the studies that Susan is talking about to answer a specific question, but it can be used to answer sort of any question you want about what you find on the door sill of somebody's home. And we're developing some techniques that are looking at the allergens that we find on the doors and seeing if there's, when we make a map of those across the country, whether there's biogeographic patterns. And then we can start to link those patterns up with things like what you're working on, like the actual conditions in the home that do vary with climate and socioeconomic status and other epidemiological factors.
Yeah. And then, you know, the key thing to remember is these are not trivial efforts either. You know, for example, the study that we're engaged in brings in building scientists, epidemiologists, clinicians, microbiologists, biostatisticians. These are non-trivial efforts to try and pull all of this data together. Typically, or traditionally, we've all worked in our own little silos. And so I think it's this very integrated effort to have a very multidisciplinary approach to understand all of the components in this causal process of disease development, which is really key to the success of truly understanding the implications of the microbial environment in the home, for example, and disease development, and which features of the home may influence that microbial exposure in the first place.
And Peter, I assume you're working in a very multidisciplinary way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Susan brings up a very important point about applying the microbiome to human health, and that is that in order for us to successfully do this, we have to break down some of the traditional silos and how we've thought about human health and how we've studied it. So we need computational biology skills, we need immunology skills, we need microbial ecology skills, and we need people who understand drug discovery and nutrition and all of those elements to be brought together in order for us to think about this, because this really is a holistic issue, and it really is about a complex ecosystem and a set of relationships that need to be understood.
Okay, let's go to the phones again. We have Pat calling in from San Francisco. Hello, Pat.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I think probably we've all noticed that the marketing and therefore the consumption of yogurt has just exploded. Could each of your guests say a few words about yogurt and the uses and abuses of that with our biome?
Who'd like to take a shot, Pete?
Yeah, well, I'll pick this up, and I actually think this ties back to the probiotic space generally. And when Katie and Susan and my team do our experiments in our labs with strains of bacteria. We're using very highly purified, very well understood strains of bacteria for these experiments. But I think that when we think broadly about the probiotic industry and what we see in nutritional supplements, what we see in yogurt, that is really in many ways a space that's been driven by marketing as much as some early science. And so I think we have to be careful about thinking through whether or not there are actually meaningful health claims about what we would get if we went to our corner grocer and picked up a probiotic or picked up some yogurt.
And I'd like to add to that. I mean, much the same as there's no two microbial species that are the same, I think if you picked up two different pots of yogurt, you're looking at two very different food products. Some, while they may have live organisms present, are really very full of sugar. And that will be counter to inoculating with a low level of microbes because you'll just enrich for fast-growing, sugar-consuming organisms in the gut microbiome. Whereas others are a little bit more natural and would have, you know, specific species that are live and potentially could confer a beneficial effect. So I think there's a wide spectrum of products out there, and the devil is in the details and reading what's on the package.
Yeah, I think it's interesting also to think about which of the organisms or the products of those organisms can actually survive the trip into the gastrointestinal tract. A lot of things, not just picking on yogurts, but a lot of things that are marketed as having beneficial health effects because of the microorganisms that they contain organisms that can't survive without oxygen in a dark, hot place, which is what our gut is. And so there's perhaps products that those organisms make that have beneficial health effects, but a lot of the organisms don't survive. They wouldn't actually be able to colonize our gut.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight we're discussing the human microbiome with Dr. Katie Pollard of the Gladstone Institute in UCSF, Dr. Susan Lynch of UCSF, and Peter DeLora, President and CEO of Second Genome. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. And speaking of email, let's go to one of our emailed questions. We have Stephen emailing in this question. Are GMOs and monocultures to blame for the newly widespread gluten intolerance? Why is it that humans are thought healthy to consume the bovine microbiomes in milk and cheese?
So I'll take the second part of that question about milk and cheese. It is pretty weird that we as adults consume milk. If you look at other species, after weaning, organisms don't consume milk of their own species. So we are weird in two ways. One is that we consume milk as adults, and the other is that we consume the milk of other species, not just our own species. But why do we do this? It's an evolutionary answer. It's actually one of the few parts of the human genome that has clearly been an adaptive event that's helped us survive as a species. And we know that's because it's happened independently in the people who originally herded cattle and goats in North Africa and a different group that did so in Europe. And both of them, those populations experienced mutations in a gene that allows us to consume the sugar that's in milk as adults. And so that's actually, that part of the story isn't about the microbiome. It's about a human genetic change. But of course, I think that any thing that we consume in our diet is translated into our body through the microbiome. And so we probably wouldn't get all of those health benefits without our microbiome.
Any other comments on that? Okay, let's move on to another emailed question. And this is for you, Susan. Dr. Lynch, what ulcerative colitis treatments related to rebuilding the healthy microbiome are currently available or on the horizon? Thanks so much, Karen. My 19-year-old daughter was diagnosed with UC at age 12. She is currently receiving treatments. We are hopeful that treatment options will improve in the near future.
So one of the more recent possibilities for ulcerative colitis is the consideration of fecal microbiome transplantation. That really hit the press quite hard recently when there was a trial that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine for a different indication, Clostridium difficile, in which the study had to actually be stopped early because it just wasn't ethical to keep the patients who were not on the treatment not getting
because
the treatment.
It was so effective.
Because it was so effective, a 92% cure rate across 16 patients that were found. And the idea with that is that you transfer a healthy donor microbiome into the recipient. So that's been considered for ulcerative colitis. There are some very small studies that have been performed that are coming into the literature now. They're not quite as efficacious as Clostridium difficile. And this, again, probably speaks to the variety of microbiotypes associated with ulcerative colitis. But this is something that we and others are interested in setting up at UCSF. The other thing we're considering is that by the time this becomes a little bit more mainstream, that we may have that refined microbial community of a very small number of microbes that would be efficacious for those kinds of indications for ulcerative colitis. And that is what we're pursuing at the moment in our group.
Yes, Peter.
Yeah, I think so. The fecal transplant work in C. difficile has really, I think, been a great example of a microbiome application. But that's a specific situation where you have an infection, there's a pathogen, and the transplant really resets the whole ecology. I think when you get into some chronic conditions like ulcerative colitis, there is an interplay that is already at work between the microbiome and the host. And so the efforts that Susan has discussed where the transplants have been used have not produced the same overwhelming effect that you see on the C. difficile side. I think in addition, it's pretty clear, well, I don't know if it's clear yet, but this is a space where it's likely that the personalized component of the baseline microbiome of that individual really matters. And it really needs to be understood how that microbiome and host are working together in a way that you can effectively address for treatment.
Absolutely. And just to expand upon that, in some individuals who've received a donor microbiome, engraftment has been wonderfully effective and they have remission of their disease. In others, it just will not take hold. So we need to understand what it is, and again, get to personalized therapy, what it is about specific microbiota that allows a donor microbiome to be engrafted and modulate immune responses in a manner that allows remission, as opposed to others who just are completely non-recipient to those kinds of microbial communities.
And so far with the fecal transplants, it's been close family members, right?
Well, it varies. There are a number of avenues, and this is something I probably don't want to get into, on FDA regulations, which are changing very rapidly. Mm-hmm. There was new rulings brought forth in March that said that the donor had to be known to either the patient or the treating physician. And so anonymous donors who've been screened and they are available through many resources, for example, Open Biome is a company that markets such donor material, that at the moment is not being permitted as donor material. So it's very
changing
new
rapidly,
and it's evolving
like, yeah.
Very quickly.
Yes.
Just wanted to add another layer to the discussion, which is in addition to the inoculation or changing of the microbiome being a treatment itself, I think that altering the composition of your microbiome might also affect the efficacy of drugs or other treatments that you would take. There's a whole emphasis in
biomedicine. None of this is happening in a vacuum here. One
right.
Change one
exactly.
Thing, right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, there's a whole emphasis in biomedicine right now about personalized medicine, realizing that different people respond differently to drugs, might need a different dose than someone else, or might just shouldn't take a particular drug because it has an adverse effect for them. And I think this is a huge opportunity to figure out all the open questions there. Some of it will be in the human DNA, but my guess is a lot of it's going to be in the microbiome as well.
Okay, let's go back to the phones now. We have Laura calling from San Francisco. Laura, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions that relate to my own personal experience. I am still a type 2 diabetic. I was diagnosed also with hypothyroidism, metabolic syndrome, and collagenous colitis. And for 20 years, no matter what I did. From the moment I was diagnosed with diabetes, I did everything right. I controlled my diet. I controlled my numbers, but I kept gaining and gaining weight. I was morbidly obese for those 20 years. And then a little past menopause, I changed doctors, and my insulin regimen was slightly changed, and I began changing nothing, began to lose weight very, very slowly for a number of years. And then, after about 2 years, it sped up. I was suddenly losing weight at a normal rate after all those years. And I have two basic questions. First of all, there is a lot of obesity in the family. I've lost almost 200 pounds, so I'm not obese anymore. But I have two relatives. I have an aunt and a cousin who were both also morbidly obese, but both sort of surprisingly and miraculously began to lose weight after menopause. So I'm wondering if there's some interaction with the microbes and hormones. That's one of my questions. The other, which fascinates me even more, though, I'm in a group, an education group. I'm still going to be fascinated with this subject for the rest of my life, no matter how thin I get. But I'm in a group with a lot of people who have had bariatric surgery, which I did not. But what fascinates me, and they don't know why, and they keep saying they don't know why, this group is led by the surgeons who do this. People who are type 2 diabetics who have that surgery, suddenly they test as non-diabetic within 12 hours. It just disappears. And nobody knows why, but they assume it has something to do with the microbes since they're removing a significant portion of their digestive system.
Thank you, Laura. Let's hear from our guests on both of those questions. Peter?
Yeah, Laura, just on the issue of gastric bypass surgery, I don't think anybody yet understands the specific relationships, but we have some work underway where we've looked at microbiomes in patients pre and post gastric bypass surgery. And as you mentioned, while there's a significant reduction in weight over time, the change to diabetic status is almost immediate. And so we are exploring the connection between the microbial community there as well. The other interesting sort of patient cohort that we're looking at is a group of obese diabetics and obese non-diabetics, and looking at the bacterial composition difference there, because we believe that there is potentially something really important and potentially causal about those bacterial community differences.
Yeah.
I thought your question about hormones was very interesting, Laura. There is some evidence in other diseases. I'm not sure myself of any in type 2 diabetes, but I know in type 1 diabetes and also in inflammatory bowel diseases that there have been some really established links with hormones. And some of these conditions get worse or arise, for example, during puberty when there's a lot of hormonal changes, and then some of them go away during menopause, as you've noted. And so there's clearly a connection with hormones. And that's something my lab at Gladstone Institutes is pursuing now in the context of inflammatory bowel diseases by studying the entire life of an organism, in this case a mouse, from birth through a disease process, and trying to see if indeed when hormones or other things are changing in the host body, how that affects the microbiome and vice versa. So trying to get at some of those cause and effect questions we've been talking about.
Okay, we have a great email question here from Wendy in San Francisco. How are the researchers on your panel changing their own behavior based on what they're learning? Who wants to start with that one?
More fish and vegetables, I think, has been the big change in our diet over the last couple of years. And just being very aware of what we consume. I mean, what we consume drives the composition of and the function of the microbes in our gut, which in turn we strongly believe, and the evidence supports, drives the overall health of the system.
But I think what our listeners would want to know, okay, so what does that mean about the types of things I should consume and the types of things I should avoid? Obviously, the research is very early right now, but this emailer is interested in hearing what you know about enough to change your own behavior. Peter, you're smiling over there.
Yeah, well, I think as Susan pointed out, I think that the efforts to eat what I'd characterize as a San Francisco diet of natural foods is a really important and actually has a meaningful effect here. The other I'm reminded in this question of a conversation I had with Susan several years ago as my wife and I were expecting our third child, and I said, okay, Susan, what do we need to do to prepare for this? And she said, well, do you have a dog yet? And I said, well, not yet. I don't think we can get a dog. She said, you need at least one dog, if not two dogs, to bring a microbiome into your environment that can be helpful there. So I do think, while it was perhaps a bit of a tongue-in-cheek comment, I think that the exposure to a complex ecology is very important, particularly for kids as they're in this really important developmental stage of those first 3 years of their lives.
And I would say that the evidence is starting to come out that for example, dietary fiber, which we've long known, but which the amount of it that we consume, particularly in Western nations, is so reduced and so low. But there was a recent study showing that feeding insoluble fiber to mice and having it metabolized by the gut microbiome protected their airways against various challenges, allergen challenge. So the products of these fibrous compounds, they get transformed into these anti-inflammatory short chain fatty acids. And, you know, the message really hasn't changed. A healthy, varied, diverse diet.
Katie, what about you?
Yeah, this question really hits home for me, Wendy. I have two pretty severe autoimmune diseases, actually. I'm constantly reading articles and trying to figure out what I could do beyond what my physician can tell me. I've tried a number of probiotic treatments and dietary changes. And what I can tell you is I think, just from my personal experience, that the effectiveness of these things may be very personal, may vary quite a bit from one person to another. For example, a probiotic that's been advocated and shown in studies to be effective for one of my diseases actually made me feel very sick when I took it. On the other hand, I took antibiotics, not for the condition, but because I had a really bad ear infection, and my symptoms suddenly went away for a period of time. So something got wiped out, or the recolonization set up a different community. So I think it's a great question. I think we're all trying to figure out what we can do besides take medications, which those of us who are sick really would like to, at least some of them, avoid if possible. I think the jury is still out from my perspective, that there's very personal responses, sometimes quite positive and sometimes quite negative.
Well, I'd like to end by asking each of you to talk about where you see the future of this research. So much has happened just in the last year and then last 5 years. What kind of breakthroughs do you think we'll see, say, in the next 5 years and then even in the longer term after that? Who'd like to go first?
Go ahead. All right, I'll jump in. I think it's a very exciting time right now. We were able to collect this data and most of the time analyze it. And I predict in the very near future, there's going to be a slew of associations discovered. So a particular microbe or a particular microbial protein is associated with X. The kind of things like we've been seeing for human genetics over the last decade, and prior to that saw for epidemiological studies, so behavioral things or diet. But to do the hard work that Peter's company does and actually figure out how to make a therapeutic that would address those associations requires having an understanding of the underlying mechanisms. And I don't think we're going to get to that in the very near future. That's a longer-term project. It's really important, and it is where the field is going. But I would say going beyond associations to actual causal effects and eventually to changes in what happens when we go to the doctor, I think is a slightly longer-term proposal.
Great. Peter, we have about 30 seconds. Tell us the future.
Yeah, well, I think this is a space that's moving very quickly. And I think that as companies start to push to these causal relationships, there will be new therapies that come out of this. And I think it really connects not only things like drug discovery, but also ties in nutrition and agriculture and diagnostics and many spaces of human health.
Susan, you get the last word.
Sure. I think we're moving towards perhaps improved understanding of the variation, for example, in disease phenotypes that we see across a population with one given disease. And in doing that, maybe understand a little bit more broadly the various ways to get to disease development, the various pathways, and ultimately moving towards some version of personalized medicine that is based on your unique and personal microbiome.
Well, we will wait and see what the future brings. That's City Visions for this evening. My guests were Dr. Katie Pollard from UCSF and the Gladstone Institutes, Dr. Susan Lynch from UCSF, and Peter DeLora, CEO of Second Genome. Thanks to all of you listeners for joining us this evening, and thanks to Katie, Susan, and Peter for being our guests. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Vision page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Victoria Thorpe. Join me next Monday as we discuss climate justice. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.